Hello, my name is Jim. I blog at The Invisible Event.
Hello, my name is Brad, and I blog at Ah Sweet Mystery.
Hello, my name is Moira, and I blog at Clothes and Books.
And we are here to discuss The Mysterious Affair at Styles by Agatha Christie. I haven't decided if there's going to be music. There might be music. I don't know. We'll see. So what has, at least in part, motivated this discussion is it is 2020, and it is 100 years since Agatha Christie published her debut novel, and ostensibly, as far as most people would see it, ushered in the start of the golden age of detective fiction. And so, since we didn't get a chance to meet up in public and to nerd out about this at the British Library the other week, Moira and Brad and I thought this would be a perfect chance to get together virtually, observe social distancing, because Brad's in California, and talk about Christie here. I guess we should probably start with a little bit of context, because it came out in 1920. It's seen, arguably, as the start of the Golden Age. What do we think about, I mean, that as a principle? What happened prior to 1920? What did detective fiction look like before this novel was published? And why do we think it had such a big impact at that time?
I'm just thinking in 1920, we had come out of a war that had had profound effect on England. We were coming out of a global pandemic, the Spanish flu, which is a misnomer because it, I think, came out of North Carolina or someplace like that. I'm sorry. And I believe you're now in the midst of a depression. So Christie was writing this book at a pretty turbulent time as well.
And how it fits in with other detective fiction, I think, is interesting, because in some ways, I do think it's probably a slightly artificial thing, but because it was Agatha Christie's first book, it has, in retrospect, been seen as starting a different genre, if that's not going too far. If you look at the other books that were published on either side of it or in the same year, there's a lot of authors who've been going for a long time, who are continuing into 1920 and past. For example, Edgar Wallace, Baroness Auxey, who wrote detective stories, other names that would be familiar to anybody who looks at those books. But what's interesting is that of the authors that you associate with the Golden Age, I think none of them had written a book by then. Dorothy Sayers, I think, started in 1923. John Dixon Carr, not till 1930. Margie Allingham, 1929. They followed on in Christie's footsteps. So from that point of view, I think it's very reasonable to start the era then. It's slightly artificial. But also, I would say that I was surprised when I started looking at this, these dates, I was surprised to find that she wasn't in the middle of a little group who then went on with her for years and years and years. She was a new young thing, just waiting for the others to go away.
The elements were all there. I was looking up authors, trying to come up with that group that I couldn't find either. But Poe had created a French detective, Lupin, in 1874, something like that. The idea of the amateur detective was there, even though the word detective wasn't being used. Christie's autobiography suggests that she was a big fan of Holmes and the stories of different writers, that she liked the genre, that she was exploring and experimenting with a genre that she was familiar with. And when you start to experiment, as I think to a certain extent she does in this book, there must have been something pretty established that unfortunately I'm just not as aware of historically.
I mean, Julian Simmons in Bloody Murder, I'm not a fan of continually trotting out Julian Simmons' criticism because he didn't really understand the puzzle novel in my estimation, but he talks about effectively two golden ages, the first one being the golden age brought about by the short story. So the likes of Auxey, of Ernest Brammer, of R. Austin Freeman, Arthur Morrison, I guess on the back of the popularity of Holmes. And I think you make an interesting point, Moira, about this idea that actually there weren't really very many people. Freeman, possibly the one exception because he'd written a few novels prior to 1920. But on the whole, Christie wasn't in the middle of this secure little group of novelists who were expanding and working with detective fiction novels. She was possibly the first one, and I should really have looked up whether this was published first or whether Freeman Wills Crofts The Cask, which was published in the same year, came out first. But Christie is essentially the first one to popularize that style of detective fiction where it's more deductive, it's more on your obscure Holmesian clues, it's more on your expert Freeman, Dr. Thorndike style of knowledge.
You know what I wish I had in front of me is Christie's Partners in Crime. Because as I recall, she is celebrating the detectives that she loved. And I know Dr. Thorndike was in there. Father Brown, was he around at the time?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. So she was basically kind of giving us a little bit of a guide to her reading history for crime as Tommy and Tuppence impersonated her favorite detectives of the day. That would have been a good guide to what she was reading and what was going on at the time.
And like you, I don't always believe everything Julian Simon says, but one of the things I think he says that's very interesting is that if you just read Sherlock Holmes, you would think that the short story was by far the best way to tell a crime story. If you just read Agatha Christie, you would conclude the complete opposite. And I was much struck by that because actually I think that's pretty much true, a good point.
Yeah, because in that sense, she does make a big mark in that she shows the sustainability of the genre in the long form. Mm-hmm. She begins to show it with this book because it's not perfect. But this is, I agree with, that's a great point.
I mean, the couple of Holmes novels at the start of the Holmes canon are essentially just long short stories, aren't they? I mean, one of them is essentially a Sherlock Holmes short story with a bit of a frontier Western stirred in. And then the other one is a short story with a long bit where they follow a dog down a river. So that's actually an excellent point. Yeah, I think that's really nice. Oh no, we're not going to end up agreeing with Julian Simmons, are we?
Breaks your heart, doesn't it?
Let's agree not to agree with Julian Simmons.
Not anything else, that's the one thing.
Okay, so a lot of detective fiction principles existed. I think we can agree wherever they came from, and there is absolutely a deeper discussion, I think, to be had around that. But a lot of the detective principles agree. And Christie almost is beginning to crystallize. And Brad, I think the idea of showing the sustainability of it over the longer form might actually end up being the key point. Just to drop Freeman Wills Crofts in again, because I am a avowed Croftian, and we're not going to talk about the start of the Golden Age in 1920 without me mentioning Crofts at least five times. So this is twice. I find it really fascinating that the two things that came out in 1920 were effectively these very polar opposite styles of detective novel, where Christie's almost struggles to get over the line. My copy, I think, is 174 pages or something ridiculous like that. Crofts very famously said that he bitterly regretted writing an additional 40,000 words for the end of The Cask because he was under the impression he would get a larger advance if it was a longer book. which I love, but it's like Christie was trying to do this very, it is an almost short story style of writing. And Crofts, I think, showed how you can expand it and how you can turn it into this multifaceted kaleidoscope of really thrilling incident. It's almost, The Cask is almost more an adventure novel, but I feel as if between them, they grew it up into what the detective novel became, you know, what it had become by certainly the mid-1920s, certainly the late 1920s.
Not having read Crofts, I can only guess, but it seems to me that the two of them laid down a sort of dichotomy between the procedural and the personal mystery. To a certain extent, Inspector Japp, who is introduced in Styles, is a stolid and effective yard man. He is, like French, a good cop, and he does a good job. There are moments in Styles when Hastings says, something's happened, this has happened. And he's like, oh, I'm sure you've misunderstood because Japp wouldn't be so stupid, my friend. Mm-hmm. He knows that Japp does his job just fine. And this is laying down the gauntlet between the people who prefer watching that more procedural aspect of police using their methods to slowly unfold a case. And then the sprite that Poirot is presented to be, leaping and gambling about throughout Styles with a completely different method of detection. And I, of course, joined that club right away.
I mean, one thing about this book is that Poirot he's so active. He's running around the whole time. He's examining the clues. He's looking for bits of paper. He's on the floor. He's crawling around. And as you say, he's leaping and gambling at one point. That was a real shock when I got to that line. It obviously struck possibly all three of us. And somebody or other this is my own original idea, has said that although Poirot is forever saying, oh, I just do the little grey cells, I just sit and think. And in fact, that's not what he does at all. He's always busybodying around, and racing off at the last minute and searching for clues and look for this. But he's not a policeman. He's not convincing as the star of the Belgian police force.
No, that is true, actually. I had not considered that. He does not come across as someone who has worked in a professional police force at all. And you perhaps understand why he doesn't anymore. No, that's an excellent point. Because the thing that really struck me, I recently finished Christie. I have now read all 80 of her Criminus novels and short story collections. And going back to the beginning, I was struck by actually how much consistency there is in the presentation of Poirot right the way across her career. As much as she didn't necessarily like writing him and got tired of him, I was really impressed at how in this early incarnation, he is still very much the Poirot of Evil Under the Sun. And he is very much the Poirot of, I'm trying to think of something in a bit later on.
Mrs. McGinty's Dead.
Perfect, thank you. Obviously, towards the end, he starts to become a bit more armchair, I suppose, and he's obviously very literally an armchair detective in Curtin because he is wheelchair bound. But I was really impressed, given how much sleuths, if you look at your Golden Age sleuths, how much they typically change over a long period, how Ellery Queen changed, how Perry Mason in the first couple of books is a wildly different character to who he ends up being 268 books later. But I was really, really taken. And I think I've got so used to him being this very Belgian, very foreign, very well, mes amis figure. I'd never thought of him as a policeman at all. It never seems credible as a policeman, not in the least.
One of the questions I was asking myself as I reread it this time was, how exactly did Poirot and Hastings know each other? I toyed for a little while with the idea of dramatizing this. And a lot of people who are big Christie fans said, there's not much that's dramatic about this. And one of the first things that came to my head as I was picturing this was how they met. I always kind of pictured it as they came across each other in some kind of official function. There was something happening in Belgium during the war that caused a lot of people to have to flee or displaced a lot of people. And that as a soldier, Hastings might have been in a position to have assisted or helped. But when you read it, it feels like Hastings is very familiar with Poirot's methods, very critical of them at a certain point. Says he's not the man I knew, he's not the man he used to be. And we have a lot to say about Hastings, I'm sure, later on. But in terms of the two of them, it's almost like they're setting it up for us to see that he actually saw Poirot in action, but I don't know how because they never talk about it. I know that the Suchet version gave them a backstory where Hastings had been involved in some intrigue and had been suspected of a crime and that Poirot had helped him out of that. You know, that's ITV doing their thing. But we don't get that information, and Christie never gives it to us. And that's kind of a shame, because I would have liked to know how they knew each other. And he has such, he really sells Poirot, and then almost immediately begins to regret it as he sees Poirot doing his job, saying, oh, he's not what he used to be. How do you know, buddy?
Yeah. At the start, Hastings does say, I quite fancy myself as a detective. And throughout the text, he peppers these little things. I have some small deductive ability, and I'm usually very good at summing people up on first sight. And so there is that implication that he has obviously thought about detection at some point in his past. There is probably a very bad series of books, isn't there, in Hastings and Poirot solving crimes when they were both younger. God, now we've said it. Someone's going to go and write.
No, that. Don't even go there.
Don't tell Sophie Hannah that.
Sarah Phelps would do a good job. Let's get her.
Absolutely.
She would. Yes.
I read this over 20 years ago. Well, about 20 years ago, and I actually thought they met in this book, and I was very surprised to reread it to discover that they already knew each other. Just as a complete aside.
So I would agree with you that Poirot changes less than most series detectives, and that the book, like all her books, is set very much at a specific time during war. I was surprised by that. I thought it was just post-war. And it's very specific. There isn't any electric light upstairs. They've got candles. All those things will change very clearly over the course of the next 70 books. But as a book, and disregarding the actual time when it was set, I thought, you know, that could have been one of her later ones. There are places where you think, no, it's not in my top 10. And there are things that she does that she probably wouldn't have done later. But still, I was very impressed with it, actually, as being in a canon of hers. She wasn't finding her way, actually. She was pretty much there.
I mean, it was written in 1916 originally, wasn't it? So she had, I guess, quite a long time to write it, and one presumes quite a long time to go back and edit and improve. I don't know how much input publishers and editors back in the early 20th century would have had. But yeah, it doesn't feel anything like as tentative as a lot of people's first swipe at this plot can be. I definitely agree with that.
Well, just in answer to what you just asked, she wrote it, she sent it out, it was rejected by at least two publishers. And then Bodley Head had been sitting on it. The readers looked at it and said, there's some promise here. They particularly like Poirot, and I think Poirot is maybe the best thing that comes out of this book. They sent a note to her. They said, talk to us. They didn't like her ending. She ended it at the trial. And so they did make her rewrite that. So they did have that power at that time. And she did rewrite it. John Curran, in one of his wonderful mystery notebooks, I think the second volume of his mystery notebooks, such a great resource, has restored the chapters of Poirot at the trial revealing the killer. Instead of that, she, I guess, invented the parlor gathering, which became the norm for every mystery writer from 1920 to 1940 and beyond, where you gather the suspects. Ellery Queen was able to do it in 120 pages in the French Powder Mystery. You know, who could write the longest parlor reveal? But she did it. And all that, the wonderful final, you know, unmasking, that's one of her great gifts in this book as well. So the publisher, who didn't do very well with her, by her, he did manage to get that out of her, which I think is a gift.
So do we know for sure, was she the first person to do what you so beautifully call the parlor reveal? It's always tempting. If you say that, somebody will find someone to your Hungarian crime story from 1916. But in general terms, she invented that, yeah?
I think so.
I was going to disagree.
Go for it.
Because Poirot is a private agent who is engaged on a case. And at the end of the case, he explains to the people who have employed him his deductions that have led to that point. There are elements of this in Holmes. There are elements of this in Ernest Brammer in the Max Carrados stories. There are elements of it in Arthur Morrison. It's not, I don't think, a wholly original tenet. She may have been the first one to do it in a novel, this long form, sustained mystery narrative. I would be a little uncomfortable saying that she absolutely invented the detective lays out all of his deductions at the end.
No. All detectives lay out their deductions at the end. The concept of the detective playing it close to the vest is not new. I'm talking strictly setting.
Okay.
And domestic setting, because one of the first mysteries, first whodunits, is buried in the middle of Deacon's Bleak House. And Inspector Bucket trails a bunch of people trying to figure out who killed Mr. Tulkinghorn. I believe when he does, it's been a few years since I read it for the third time, but I believe he comes to Lady Dedlock, who is the main suspect, to tell her what he's discovered and to uncover the killer. At that point, the killer is uncovered, but not everybody is there.
Yeah.
A few key people are there, but not everybody. He has to come and tell Lady Dedlock because he owes it to her because she has suffered so much, but also because the killer happens to reside there. But this is one where he says, Miss Cynthia, you sit here. And, oh, Miss Evelyn, you helpful person, you sit here. And everybody will wait for Mr. Inglethorpe and we will begin. He stages his solution. And I think if I'm wrong, then you can say my guess was wrong. I'm sorry, everybody. But I think she kind of did that.
I think that's probably fair. And I'm no authority on this. But certainly, yeah, that very deliberate staging of, as you say, who's sitting where, managed like that. Probably in that case, yeah.
We'll give you that, Brad.
Yay!
I thought a way to structure this, and I should obviously stress, this is titled Spoiler Warning. So from this point on, you may consider that spoilers will be dropped deliberately, accidentally. We are going to go into all of the details. We do not need to hold back on Mysterious Affair at Styles, at least. Other books, I think, will try to be a bit more circumspect, but Styles in particular will be spoiled. What I thought we could do is, if we each pick, say, something about the book that we particularly enjoy, and then, depending on how that goes, we each pick something that we thought could have been improved or something that we thought was evidence of some shortcoming in the book and have a bit of a discussion around that. The first thing I would start off with, and this is my third mention of Freeman Wills Crofts, is one of the things I particularly enjoy about this, because it has it in common with the cask, and I'm sorry, they're laughing at me, everybody. They're laughing at me on my screens. Is I love this idea that what these two novels really started to introduce was the ability for you as the reader to examine verbatim certain clues that the detective received. So we know the letter sent by Emily Inglethorpe, we find out at the end, was sent on the 7th. But Evelyn has added a 1 into it to make it look like it was a letter she was sent on the 17th, and the spacing of the characters became important. If this was just typed out onto the page without being a handwritten thing, if we would miss that. This need to re-spell possessed to see if it's actually one S or two S's in the middle, although we discovered my edition has it spelled correctly every single time. So somebody obviously didn't get the memo on in that case. But again, being able to see the handwriting, being able to see the charred fragment of the will, which is dug out of the fire, which was something that was repeated again in Orient Express. I love this idea that it makes the occlusion of the guilty party harder because you have to actually show us the clues literally as the detective is seeing them. The counterexample of this is something like The Wrong Shape, the story by G.K. Chesterton, in which the thing which is the wrong shape, a piece of paper, we're described in very generalities, and that shape ends up being crucial. And in a way, that's, for me, part of the way in which both of these books really signified something new happening in the genre from 1920 onwards. I love the idea that both of these books present physically information where the precise physical appearance of it is so crucial to understanding what's going on.
I counted 5 places in the book where something was reproduced, whether it was the plan of the house, the plan of the room, the blotting paper, the possessed, the bit that turned out to be the will, and the letter with the key. And I, despite having read the book before, I knew that there was something about that letter because it wouldn't have been reproduced. And I still didn't get it. I didn't remember it. She was a mistress of cluing. I mean, I really think she was. I think she must have gone through her life noticing things and thinking, ooh, could use that. That could be a clue. She likes, because in, I think, Lord Edgware Dies, there's a letter which is important, and in The Moving Finger also. She likes that. And you would say, oh, she's keen on letters, but actually I think she's just keen on clues. She's keen on getting things past you. I wouldn't know enough about what had been going on until then, but that's a really excellent point of her saying that, so you can see it. So we are on equal terms.
I do think that she became less interested or concerned with physical clues as her career took off, and more with interpersonal and verbal clues, which were my favorite. There are a few of them here, but for the most part, there's quite a bit of physical cluing here. And that whole sequence in Emily's bedroom after the murder, when Poirot first comes and has his 6 points of interest, although he neglects to say one at first, there's a little bit of a confusion there, but he does have a lot of physical evidence to examine. So yeah, she showed a mastery over that right away. And I do appreciate the maps. I always love maps and snatches of a letter and things like that to actually see. It's very Croftsian to focus on physical evidence and enjoy that.
It's interesting that the physical space, the maps, are probably the least important of these reproduced clues, though, aren't they? It doesn't matter if we know that Mary Cavendish's room is on the other side, precisely where it is on the other side, because she can't hear the table be falling, because there's nothing about seeing the physical layout of the space that matters. Hastings stands outside the room. Poirot comes back 20 minutes later and, oh, mon ami, you heard nothing? He's like, no, I heard nothing. Okay, cool, let's carry on. And Hastings, incidentally, so dense to not pick up on what was going on there. And I think possibly the conversational clues that she went on to rely on are the kinds of things that would more easily occur to somebody. She famously said that the best ideas come to her when she's doing the washing up, when it's just something entirely stray floats in. I think that must be fascinating.
There are a couple of clues that she uses in this first book that she uses throughout her career that I love. The first is the dying message. Alfred, Alfred. What does that mean? I'm thinking of John Christo in The Hollow saying Henrietta. There are so many examples of this. She does the dying message very well because it's more natural and less cute than Ellery Queen. And then the look over the shoulder, she uses that in some of my favorite books. And she starts it out here with Lawrence looking horror-struck over Hastings' shoulder. And it's like, what did he see? Ultimately, it becomes what it becomes, which is not as important. It actually helps reveal a love angle that we hadn't been as aware of if we were as dense as Hastings. But I'm thinking of Satipi in Death Comes as the End, looking over Yamos' shoulder. And I'm thinking of Major Palgrave looking over Miss Marple's shoulder in A Caribbean Mystery. And over, she does that so well. And she does it differently in every one of her books, which is just a testament to what we'll see is her diversity, her imagination.
Yeah, because there's also the mirror crack from side to side.
Oh, where the best example of that, of all of them.
What was one it? Of, yeah. And you cannot tell from one of those what it's going to mean in any of the other cases. She could...
And the real shame about that is there's a really lovely subtle behavior clue with Poirot straightening the vase on the mantelpiece that would not have needed straightening if no one had touched it since he last straightened it. And that's gorgeous, but that you can only really use once, because as soon as you've seen it in one of her books, people are going to be, oh, Poirot straightening a thing again. I wonder if that's something that was unstraightened by someone else. And I loved that. I forgot that. I forgot most of this book. It's such a shame that she wouldn't have the chance to use that again, because that one's just so beautifully subtle.
That was just, I kind of knew there was something about it. But also, what it did have was that trope she loves where he suddenly says, I'm an imbecile. Like, how could I have been it?
Well, it
300 times.
Yeah, because number one, it comes out of his character. So yes, she utilizes an element of his character to tell plot story, to clue. Also, it's the first example of Hastings doing something completely off the wall that leads him, you know, he grabs Hastings, kisses him on both cheeks and says, it is you. You have solved this case for me. And Hastings is scratching his head.
That's your, that's the Holmes-Watson dynamic, isn't it? Where Watson says the wrong thing that's accidentally the right thing. Yeah. I think maybe that's part of why it's so difficult to see this as a completely new start, because inevitably you have to use so much of what has come before. But she then turns it to such great new usage, I think.
One of the things I like very much is the complexity of the plot, the number of different strands. It's completely unrealistic, but I'm fine with that. I can remember when I was a young thing starting to read Agatha Christie that what I loved was the subplots, the items that turned out to be very relevant to somebody else, but they're just looking for murder investigation and they have to be cleared out of the way before you can find out who did the murder. And I've always enjoyed that about her, and this was a very good one. There is one thing in the book that's interesting. I don't know if you noticed this. So 2/3 of the way through, we're clear to say anything, right?
Absolutely.
About what happened.
Yeah, absolutely.
We find out that Dr. Bauerstein is a spy and he's arrested. But Dr. Bauerstein is a witness in the trial. Dr. Bauerstein is called in to discuss the medical details. Now, actually, I think it's just a mistake.
They do say that Bauerstein is acquitted and is going to have, therefore, have had his wings clipped, and so will perhaps not get to be quite so open. So he's not actually found guilty of espionage. He's merely suspected of espionage.
Oh, really? I didn't actually know where that went past me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, he's acquitted.
Yeah. At what point is that, then?
Right at the end.
Between his arrest and the trial.
Yeah.
Sorry, well, I guess the best they can do. Sorry, Maya.
Okay, well, that's fine. Anyway, but I still think it's slightly odd that the spy is brought into the court case. And it says, I take it, Dr. Bauerstein, that strychnine as a drug acts quickly and that you're unable to account for the delay in this case. So I was quite surprised to see that. Perhaps yes. Not as surprised as I shouldn't have been so surprised.
The espionage plot here, I mean, it's only a very small plot, but the fact that it builds into this certain amount of misdirection around what's going on with people's various relationships at least makes it an element of what's going on. It reminded me very much, and I'm going to make Brad angry when I say this, but it reminded me very much of the espionage plot in Death on the Nile, which is the randomest, most unconnected and entirely pointless page-filling bit of thing ever to be put on a Golden Age detective fiction page. And I found it really interesting that her first book, she introduces this espionage idea and actually integrates it quite well. And then however many books later on, she almost as an afterthought goes, oh, there should be a spy, shouldn't there? Yeah, yeah, we should have Johnny Rayson there looking for a spy.
It is not as worthless as Dr. Bauerstein being a spy, but it is a worthless subplot. And Dr. Bauerstein being a spy, a Polish Jew spy, is one of the more offensive moments in this book. And I find it interesting when you talk about subplots that John and Mary have both picked, you know, a gypsy girl and a Polish Jew. They couldn't find anyone of their own class to dawdle with because they really wanted each other. So they both picked inappropriate people to be lured away by, so that there would be absolutely no problem with them coming back to each other at the end.
Connotations of that aren't great, are they?
No.
But can I just go back to the spy thing? Because I think one of the most surprising lines in the book is that Hastings, when Dr. Bauerstein has been arrested, says, oh, the guy's a blackguard, he's so wicked. And Burrow says, well, on the contrary, he's a patriot. If you did this, you would be a blackguard. But he believes in something and he's got a lot to lose and I admire him. And then it just passes on and nobody goes, but I think that's an incredibly unexpected line in a book.
I noticed that line and loved it too. I thought it shows us something of Poirot that we don't really see much in subsequent books, that he has an intelligent sensibility as a foreigner. He's not just using it sometimes to get past or through the English, but that he has a point of view that people not born in England might have. And it was interesting.
Yeah, and for sure, her readers on the whole would have been on Captain Hastings' side, I would imagine, not on Poirot's side. It's very unusual.
There is a point where, who is it? Mary and John are talking about her infatuation with Bauerstein. I think it's when Hastings falls asleep in the wood. And John says, it will be the talk of the village. My mother was only buried on a Saturday, and here you are gadding about with the fellow. Oh, she shrugged her shoulders. If it's only the village gossip that you mind. But it isn't. I've had enough of the fellow hanging about. He's a Polish Jew anyway. And then, the bit that really surprised me, she replies, a tinge of Jewish blood is not a bad thing. It leavens the, she looked at him, stolid stupidity of the ordinary Englishman. which again is just very, very surprising. And I'd not considered your perspective on it, that actually the idea is this is a very deliberate attempt to go for the most easily dismissed, is that the right word for it, alternative to her English husband. I'd actually seen that as a very positive thing, given that we know Christie and just about every Golden Age writer ever has faced accusations of anti-Semitism, of which some of them were undoubtedly guilty.
I think you're on the right track there. I think she likes Bauerstein because he pays attention to her and all that. But really, we don't get all this until the very, very end. She loves John. The whole marriage thing has transformed for her, but not for him. And as she's so tired of his stolidity and his stupidity, that she's trying to make him jealous. Mm. Or she's excited that a man's talking to her. Of course, he's trying to pump her for information. She doesn't know that. But she appreciates his attention. And the anger it generates in John, but John doesn't handle it right. Instead of saying, no, you fool, I realize I love you and I want you, he goes off with the gypsy girl. So they both do stupid things at that point. Yeah. But you know, I do think that she likes Bauerstein. He's an interesting man, and he is much more perceptive of how to generate interest in a woman than John is, or Hastings, or any Englishman in Christie.
What kind of espionage work do we think he was doing that he's gathering it from Mary Cavendish?
I thought really that had not been worked out. And then they suddenly say, oh, it's near the coast, so...
Well, yeah, we're 4 miles from the coast.
It must be boats. I'm trying to remember. So, you know, I'm trying to write this terrible little thing on my blog, and it involves stolen submarine plans. So I did look up submarines to make sure they had been built by then. There were submarines in World War I. So yes, there may be a sighting or a desire to bring in the German U-boats or the German submarines onto the shores of England. That might be what he was doing.
I think, was it not more that he was flirting with Mary in order to distract attention from himself?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I'm being entirely facetious. I do apologize. Yes. Yes.
Well, I think it's important to get the methods of the methodology of the spies right.
I agree.
Yeah, it's very hard to see. I mean, Cynthia was in the hospital and might have had something important in the hospital, mightn't she?
That's true. Yeah,
that is true. Treating a general or something.
Emily was the Lady Bountiful. She was the female squire. So her home would be a center of information at the beginning when they talk about the fete and all the things that they're planning to do. Dr. Bauerstein is going to get a lot of information about what's going on in the village through the inhabitants of Emily's home. So he's in a good position there.
Yeah, vital information. Yeah, vital. Yeah. Right,
like,
guys are not sleeping.
Right. The war will not be won unless they can figure out what's going on in this the hamlet in the middle of nowhere. Yeah.
In Essex.
So I like the readability of this book. It's too long. There are problems. I have some problems with it, which we'll talk about later. But I like that it is inherently readable and quite funny. I think that Hastings is one of the most infuriating characters in literature to me. He gets stupider as the book goes on. He becomes unbearably dense through the book as the book progresses. And it becomes infuriating for me, but also very funny the way he misinterprets everything. Late in the book, around the time that Poirot kind of throws out the fact that Bauerstein is a spy and starts to explain why he was showing so much attention to Mary, he then says, Hastings, then you think he never really cared for her, for Mary? I asked eagerly, rather too eagerly, perhaps under the circumstances. That, of course, I cannot say. But shall I tell you my own private opinion, Hastings? Yes, well, it is this, that Mrs. Cavendish does not care and never has cared one little jot about Dr. Bauerstein. Do you really think so? I could not disguise my pleasure. I am quite sure of it, and I will tell you why. Yes, because she cares for someone else, mon ami. Hastings doesn't get it. Oh, what did he mean? In spite of myself, an agreeable warmth spread over me. I am not a vain man where women are concerned, but I remember certain evidences, too lightly thought of at the time, perhaps, but which certainly seem to indicate he is that vain. He is that stupid. He proposes to Cynthia. I love the women in this book and how Cynthia looks at him. First, she's a little offended. Then she laughs hysterically and says, "You've made me feel so much better. Bye-bye." He doesn't interpret anything right. And when Poirot is making a slow, steady progress in terms of deduction, he gets impatient. He's like a lap dog or a big dog that kind of is like going, "What are we doing now? What are we doing now? Are we going to have dinner? What's going on? What's going on?" He drives me crazy, but it provides a lot of humor. And some of the dialogue, the way she handles little characters, Dorcas is a wonderful character, the maid, the interactions between people are quite charming. And I think one of the things she was able to do so well was provide information through conversation in a way that entertained and also enlightened. So I enjoy that a lot in this book. As I said, I love her verbal work. When she creates verbal clues or clues within conversation, that's why After the Funeral is one of my favorite books, because people discuss things so casually there and reveal so much.
Yeah, I mean, Hastings is the original unreliable narrator, really, isn't he? Because he doesn't see anything. Although it was quite surprising that this little charming flirtation with Mary, the flirtation with Cynthia is one thing, but the little charming flirtation with Mary, maybe I can get it on with that. He's talking about his great friend's wife. And okay, they're not that happy at the moment. But what does he think's going to happen?
What a well, jerk. John,
you go off with the gypsy lady and I'll have Mary.
While Lawrence thinks that John likes Cynthia, nope, the British men in this book are not very bright when it comes to understanding people or each other or what's going on in that house. And I think Christie has a lot of fun with the stolid, stupid Englishman in this book.
One of my favorite examples of that is a bit later on. It's in the chapter entitled Fresh Suspicions. And they're talking about the beard that has been found. And Poirot says, the beard was cut exactly in the shape of Mr. Inglethorpe's, and I found one or two snipped hairs. Hastings, this affair is very deep. Who put it in the chest, I wonder? Someone with a good deal of intelligence, remarked Poirot dryly. You realize that he chose the one place in the house to hide it where the presence would not be remarked. Yes, he is intelligent, but we must be more intelligent. We must be so intelligent that he does not suspect us of being intelligent at all. I acquiesced. There, mon ami, you have been of great assistance to me. I love that.
At the same time, Poirot does handle that aspect of Hastings very well. At a certain point toward the end, Hastings is very hurt that he was not brought into Poirot's confidence. And Poirot begins the argument he will carry on through their relationship, which is, you have such an open, beautiful countenance that you are incapable of true deceit, and a good detective has to be deceitful. Mm. You can't do that. As soon as Inglethorpe saw you, he would have latched on to what was going on, and we would not have been able to catch him. So he gives Hastings an out, and there are things that he loves about Hastings, and Hastings does have a tendency to accidentally glom onto some truth that helps Poirot. That happens over and over, as it happens here. I do like that. I love Poirot and I love their relationship and I love the humor and the way the book, when it's flowing, it flows. It's a little long, but when it flows, it flows.
One of the things I like is right at the beginning, he meets his old friend John, and then John says, come and stay, and then describes this appalling situation at home. And that he says, eventually Hastings says, it must be a difficult situation for you all. And John says, difficult? It's damnable. And any normal person at this point would say, well, no, I won't come and stay with you for a month. But 3 days later, I turned up on the train to go there. Any normal person would say, maybe I'll come and visit you. But he's coming to stay for a month in this household, which we have just described in the most awful way.
There are two other, people criticize Christie for not being humorous, not being a good writer. I think she writes quite well here. And also I think her characterization, for the most part, is quite good, particularly her descriptions of Mary. She obviously likes that character. And I also love the subtlety of Emily Inglethorpe And oddly enough, it really is brought to mind by Evelyn, one of her killers, who says this was not a woman who was very, she was generous but selfish about it. You've spoken with us, Moira, about some similarities between this and Ordeal by Innocence. And you see that same kind of person as a victim in that later book, where Mrs. Argyle is so giving and loving of these children. And she's not at all giving or loving of these children. She thinks she is, but she likes being thought of that way more than she likes giving. And Emily was like that too, because you think, here's a woman who's doing her best to be at the top of her community and to help the community. Why the heck did she marry this guy? She knew it would cause trouble because he fed her ego in such a way. And you see that again later on with Arlena Marshall, a very different kind of woman. But ultimately, Arlena Marshall is a victim because she needs affirmation as a person. And I think that's an interesting character that Christie did very well in a variety of guises.
And so early. Yeah, exactly. To do it here for the first time so early as well is phenomenal.
Does anyone have any idea how old Alfred is? Throughout the book, I kept wondering about this.
I think it says he's at least 2 decades younger than her.
So I figured in his late 40s, early 50s.
Because I think after Hastings meets John, John's like, oh, my mother's remarried. And Hastings' like, oh, she would probably be in her 70s now.
Yeah.
And I think they say, again, somewhere in that first chapter, I think it says that he is at least 2 decades younger.
Right. And Evelyn is in her 40s, I think. I thought in a way it was neither one thing nor the other. You know, he wasn't 30, was he? He was older than that.
Yeah.
But he wasn't, he wasn't suitable by being her own age. Hmm.
He is to me the least drawn character of them all.
But is that slightly deliberate, do we think? Because again, in that first chapter, he is described as an absolute outsider, largely because he wears boots in all weathers.
Patent leather boots. Not just boots, he wears patent leather boots.
Good heavens.
That's impossible.
I mean, but then doesn't Poirot wear patent leather? But then Poirot is also an outsider, I suppose. Is it just because he starts off as an outsider and then at the end he remains, he becomes the ultimate outsider because he conspires to commit this murder? And this is the thing leveled at Golden Age detective fiction all the time, isn't it? It's always about identifying the outsider and being sure to shun them.
He also doesn't need to be more. He is what Christie sets out in her first markedly clever idea. He is the most likely suspect and therefore worthy of dismissal. So immediately you put him in your place as a reader. He is the guy who is most likely to have done it, has the strongest motive, so I must cross him off my list and look to see who the real killer is. Which brings to mind another thing that I like about this book. It doesn't really happen till later on, but when they finally dismiss Inglethorpe as a possible suspect, there's a wonderful moment between John and Hastings where John says how stressed he is and how sad he is, because if it isn't the outsider, it has to be one of them. And yes. I don't remember as many instances later on of feeling that surus, that sense of pain that you feel when you know that someone in that close circle of loved ones must be a killer. They're not revealing it to you for reasons of self-preservation, which automatically poisons all those relationships. And you get that sense in this book when John talks to Hastings, and it's a very powerful moment.
I think you're right, and I think we can be, to a certain extent, grateful that Christie never really lent into that too successfully after this, because it gave Christiana Brand space in which to write, and we would have missed out on a bunch of wonderful, I'm not a fan of all of her books, but her casts and the relationships between them. I mean, God, there are some killers in Christiana Brand I'll never forgive her for, because of how horribly it just upsets that core group of people. So it's a bad thing for Christie, but you know, we benefited long term.
if we're going to move on at any point to things that she started doing better. In fact, one of them I thought was, it's a trope in Christie that anybody might be guilty. Nobody is really free from suspicion. If you're reading a book like a Miss Silver book, a Patricia Wentworth book, you pretty much know there's a young couple and they are not going to be guilty. And in one of the Wentworth books, there's a scene where somebody goes and visits Miss Silver and looks around and there's pictures in silver frames of all the happy couples she's helped and saved over the years. And when I was writing about this, I said, well, you wouldn't get that in Christie. What you'd see was a lot of miserable people. Had their lives blighted and their loved one disappeared. There's no beautiful silver photographs in Miss Marple's thing. But I think it's also true that much less, she was obviously, she uses snobbishness a lot in the books. Yes. She uses it a lot to try to trick you. But she is much less prone, again, than some of her contemporaries, in that it's going to turn out to be the nasty little person, the horrible person, the little person, the outsider. It can be anybody. And I don't think, if she was writing this one later, that she would have made quite so much of Alfred being the complete outsider.
To what extent, this is maybe getting a bit too big, but to what extent did Golden Age detective fiction lean into it being the horrible person who ends up being like the one who you really want to be the killer because they're so hideous? How prevalent is that in Golden Age? Because I would say that's very much a Holmesian thing. I'd say that's very much from the earlier fiction that we were talking about before. My overall impression is that a lot of the time in Golden Age detection, is it that prevalent that it was the outsider? It is your Alfred Inglethorpes, if you like. Did he become the model for a lot of things? Because it almost feels the exception to me.
Right. It's not necessarily the horrible person. It's just that it is often the person who didn't have the right upbringing, I think.
Okay.
When you think of some of her family mysteries, Hercule Poirot's Christmas is a family mystery, and a member of the family must be the killer. And when you go to Appointment with Death, again, you're dealing with a tight, dysfunctional family, each of which loathes the victim. And she plays with the whole concept of an outsider. Because the victim is so bored torturing her family, she needs to spread her web outward. So she does like to play a little bit. I didn't even think of that, but she does often like to have the outsider. And not to create that neat little Miss Silver kind of everyone pairs up at the end, although they kind of do in this particular first novel. But for the most part, it's just she does like to play with that. And another thing that I think is she likes to play with is that character, that victim, who overextends their influence, who tries for a little too much control. Having read a little bit more biographical material about Christie over the last year or so, to know that her family was not very traditional. You know, her father died young, she and her mother, there was a lot of sense of kind of struggle. Her sister left and married a very wealthy man, but she was always struggling and struggling financially quite a bit. And she writes about these tight-knit, well-off families where the patriarch or the matriarch just exercise a little bit too much control, sort of make their families, they weaken them by giving too much. I find that a really interesting familial relationship that Christie played with a lot and starts with here. They talk a lot about John and his trial as being a profligate and a spendthrift and a kind of a leech-like person, but he's just a powerless man who, through his father's stupid will, is waiting for the chance to get his hands on something.
Yes, well, Christian mothers is a very, very interesting thing because she obviously had an almost unnaturally close relationship with her own mother.
Yeah.
But you suspect it was very controlling, whereas her relationship with her daughter just always sounds terrible. She didn't have a good relationship, I think, with her daughter. And so she had two very different sides to her, I think. And she says herself that when her mother died, she says herself that she became too upset, unnaturally upset almost, and that led to the whole Archie debacle. I mean, he obviously was not blameless in this, but that she should have been more aware of the effect that it was having on him. She was ignoring him because of her grief.
I have read that of her mother described as a manipulative woman, you know, a woman who used her emotions and her worries to control her daughter and lure her daughter out of her own life, which kind of resembles some of these.
Yeah, it's always, I'm always, in any Christie, I'm always looking at the mothers and daughters particularly, but there aren't any in this one, are there?
Not daughters, no.
Salome and Rosalie Otterbourne, I look for them too. Because the mothers and sons are so interesting. These weak, you know, the Allertons and communist writer in The Murderers Announced and his mother. And then, you know, the moms in Dumb Witness and in The Hollow, where motherhood is a symbol of, I don't know what it is. These are very strange, weak women who pour everything into their children in a way that seems very unhealthy. If we're going to talk about things that we are not as fond of in this book, I do think that in terms of plot structure, she was still working on her skill, and that on a number of occasions, there's a bit of an info dump that can be a little discombobulating for me. The first chapter, if you try and chart what happens in the first chapter, there are these seven people wandering around, staring with hard looks at other people wandering around. They're seeing and misinterpreting everything they see, and it happens very fast. And that we have everything brought to a head so quickly, I would have actually loved to see a little bit more of the family in action before we see Mrs. Inglethorpe die. Although I understand in classic mysteries that may not have been in that case. And then while some of it is very clever, the scene in the bedroom after the murder with the six points of interest just seemed too much for me. There's just so much. I start to feel a little of Hastings' impatience going, what did you find now, Poirot? It's like, oh, this is of such interest. Look at this. Oh, the spill vases and the dispatch key and the coffee stain and the cocoa grounds and another thing I'm not even going to tell you about until a page from now because I just can't keep it in. There's an awful lot of stuff. I think she started to learn how to maybe parse it out a bit better almost immediately. I think even the next book she does the clues better.
Yeah, she gives out a little bit of information fairly early on when Hastings is asking him how Poirot knows that she didn't drink the coffee or the strychnine wasn't in the coffee when it was drunk at a particular time. And that's in chapter 4 quite early on. And Poirot's response to this request is, I do not mind telling you, although as you know, it is not my habit to explain until the end is reached. And I wonder if to a certain extent, this is partly because we don't know Poirot. We, the readership at that stage, the readership in 1920, you have no evidence that Poirot is any good. And in fact, if you don't see a certain amount of the deduction then, the majority of your experience of Poirot throughout the book is going to be Hastings going, well, he's not as good as he used to be. And so I wonder if that was just like an early convincer. But then I think you're right. I think suddenly everything concertinas towards the end. You get this massive, I think quite well paced things happening in the middle, but then the explanation is really
It slows down and we get to meet the people. I sometimes felt like she was feeling her way through, or maybe because it took so long to write the book, she sometimes did something that she then changed and it kind of didn't get changed all the way through, got missed.
But I love that perception that I come to it now and I've read every Poirot book many times. And so I know where I'm going. If I was reading it in 1920 and I've just picked it up.
You wouldn't have David Suchet in your head and you wouldn't know that he's this genius character straight away.
And you wouldn't know the way that he solves the case because I actually wrote down, you know, as one of my notes, there's lots of early clues and early resolutions in it where he shows Hastings and us via the unreliable narrator that yes, he is really smart. But yeah, that's a great point.
I think it's as well on this the sudden sort of slight clumsiness, or this slight sort of hurriedness or insufficiency or whatever you want to call it towards the end. I think it's both a shame and inevitable that it becomes a little bit John Road with the bromide powders crystallizing out to form whatever, because obviously through her knowledge working in the dispensary, she would have been aware of this. You know, Christy had this understanding, this knowledge of chemistry as we know. And it's undoubtedly, I think it's fair to say, that was in her mind the germ for the book. So it all sprung from that idea. But I think it's a shame, having gone to such lengths to be very careful to go, as I discussed earlier, about this verbatim presentation of physical information. I think the thing that gets on my nerves 100 years later is they go, here's this chemical formula. It's incredibly well known to anybody who's ever read a chemistry textbook. And you're like, is it?
Evidently, some text had come out about the effect of bromides on strychnine. Yes. I don't think it was in everybody's household. I don't think your average, Haypenny thriller reader had it on their shelf. It's not fair that we would be expected to possess that knowledge in order to solve the crime. So there's a certain matter of fair play. I guess we can quibble with the fair play elements of this particular book, although the shape of it is such that it suggests fair play. And some of them, as Moyer said, some of the clues are so legitimately clever. The one with the vases and the straightening up is so brilliant. It shows so much promise because it's a series of actions that in and of themselves mean nothing, and taken together reveal so much. However, what it leads to is the discovery of a letter, which is my least favorite clue, that basically says, hey, honey, didn't have time to throw this away, but can't wait to mail this to you and tell you, hey, we did it. We killed the old lady. You know, it's like, this is what you had to do. This is what you had to give us at the end. Why? That so almost spoils it for me.
So annoying.
Yes, that is terrible. And she would have done better later.
The letter is an awkward deus ex machina. It's a feeble solution. And she didn't do that again, to my recollection. She used documents. She used letters in a much more brilliant way. And I'm thinking of the use of a letter in And Then There Were None, or of one of her great late 40s novels, where a written document becomes the nexus of understanding the killer's plot. There's another wonderful example in Toward Zero, where you actually see the killer writing down the plan for murder. It's such a wonderful moment that Christy does so well, where we don't understand. We don't know the sex of the killer. We don't know anything about them descriptively. We just know that an insane mind is scribbling a murder plot, hatching their plot on paper, and they write it all down in great detail, and then they burn it and cackle, and then we move on to the book. Christy really did learn how to use documents, but that letter... she should have been ashamed of herself for that letter.
I hope she was.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I agree with you a lot about this. I'm having said that what I liked was the early use of multiple plots and multiple bits and pieces. I think she didn't, she was going too slowly at some points too. It was all that timing that she got much better at. And so by the end, in fact, having said that we're not quite sure about how fair play the poison thing was, but it almost gets lost by the time I'd completely forgotten about the narcotic that Mary Cavendish has. I mean, that scenario that she's drugged two people in order to come in the middle of the night to search something. Just thinking,
search for something that doesn't exist.
Well, yeah.
And there are so many people who know about poison in that little household. They are experts on poison, you know, so many of them. And at the same time, they're not all of them are developed. So I don't think Lawrence is a very well-developed character.
No.
Lawrence.
And I like younger brothers, but he's not. And there's that wonderful little moment where they're all chattering away at the dispensary early on. They've gone to visit Cynthia at work. And she says, oh, no, let's all go out here for tea. No, 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 not there, Lawrence. That's the poison closet. Let's go. And of course, if I was an experienced Christie reader, I'm going, what was he doing in the poison closet? And I make a little note to watch Lawrence. But there's not much to watch through most of the rest of the book. And I think that's a little bit of a weakness. I wish he were better developed.
I mean, he has to go to the poison closet so that he can express an interest in a bottle that will have his fingerprints on later, because otherwise we have no real reason to suspect him. That is Lawrence's entire character arc in the book, isn't it? I mean, nothing comes of Poirot having discovered Lawrence's fingerprints on the bottle. They just go, oh, you opened the cupboard and you took down the bottle. And he says, yes, I was interested. And they go, oh, okay. And you go, Lawrence, everybody. Now he's off and he's going to marry Cynthia.
But actually, it's a bit similar, because there is a scene in Five Little Pigs where they visit the Nazi cemetery.
Yeah.
And I always felt that there's something that's not really explained, why somebody took whatever it was they took from there. But again, it's just, she likes a scene where people visit a dispensary. There's two in that book.
A couple of things are taken in the Five Little Pigs example. I'm thinking, did everyone feel they could help themselves to things when they go to visit a poison's cupboard? I mean, come on.
Well, it is surprising there weren't more people dying.
Right.
It is called the dispensary, right? They do give stuff out, so people are just going and taking stuff. Why not?
There's a very weird bit where Poirot asks Hastings to say to Lawrence, and it's not at all clear why he can't just say it himself, if you find the sixth coffee cup, you will rest in peace. It's just mysterious. And the whole business of how many coffee cups there should be. She sort of threw it away. I thought that was actually quite a good Christie-ish thing, the business that the maid would have thought there were five or there were six, should there have been six, should there have been seven, was the one missing. But it all got kind of scrunched up at the end.
And then sugar, did he really taste each one?
You know what, by the end of that book, I didn't know what had gone on with coffee cups, cocoa, what there was in any of these things, how many cups there were. But I do think the cups could have been a good, clever clue, but she threw it away, and she wouldn't have done that later.
Well, I'm trying to think, you know, people had to think very fast in those moments. So let's picture Lawrence. Lawrence walks in, his mother is having paroxysms of pain. So he must know, because he studied to be a doctor, she was poisoned. Mm. He looks over, he sees that Cynthia's door is not bolted. So he automatically assumes that Cynthia poisoned her for no reason, because Cynthia has no motive to poison Mrs. Inglethorpe. She did nothing but good for her. Now he looks and he sees the coffee cup. He figures that she has poisoned the coffee cup. So he grinds the coffee cup. Well, these are all these clues, these red herring clues, but what is going on in this guy's head that he would get to those places so quickly? You know, when this woman is screaming, oh my God, it's like thinking like you're in a mystery that's a little awkwardly presented in this first book.
Yeah.
I think the idea that he's obviously so in love with Cynthia, he thinks she poisoned my mother. I must protect her so that I can marry her at a later date is a curious.
Which yes. I will set up. After protecting her, I will then sulk and pout and say bad things to her, rude things to her, so that she thinks I hate her.
This is how people show they're in love in Golden Age detective novels, though, isn't
true.
It?
Yes.
I've just finished reading one book where they're like, oh, it turns out the young female character is in love with one of the young male characters, and it's not the one you think. And they go, oh, how did you know that you were so in love with him? And she's like, well, because every time he said anything, it really got on my nerves. And every time I said anything, I really got on his nerves. So obviously we're in love. And you're like, I mean, I've been in love.
What world are you in? Yes.
The thing, to come back to Lawrence and the coffee cup clue, the thing that I think is a real wasted opportunity there is Hastings says it to Lawrence, and then Lawrence asks him to repeat it. Almost as if Lawrence has caught something in the phrasing that might mean something. And I think you're right, Maura. I think the final part of it is like, you will finally rest in peace, or you will be able to rest in peace, which puts funerals in my mind, you know, which doesn't imply you're going to go on to find eternal happiness because of the release. If he could get in like a till death do you part, which is at least in the wedding vows, and there was something subtle going on there, so an indication of future happiness with the woman you love. I'm with you. I think it's a real sort of wasted kind of nothing, and it could have been something. It almost becomes something.
The other plot point that drives me crazy is towards the end, Hastings, they've arrested John, and Hastings comes upon Poirot, and Poirot's like, oh, or maybe they haven't arrested him yet. And he's like, oh, Hastings, I don't know what to do. I've tried to think about a woman's happiness, and ultimately decides that the best thing he can do to make Mary happy is to have John be arrested and tried. For months, he's imprisoned and tried at great expense under the British court system for murder, so that Mary can get off her duff and finally declare, as she does immediately. It says the first lines of the chapter, Mary was splendid. Even I saw that she clung like a tiger to her defense of her husband. And we see the love grow. And I'm thinking, this is why you did this. Although the secondary reason is that then it's easier to catch Alfred if we all let him think that.
Sure, but it would have been the death penalty and there was no court of appeal, right?
Right.
So.
Yeah. It's quite a serious chance to take, isn't it?
Yes.
I love it.
Yes. One thing I think that didn't change over the years, that it's there in that book in a minor way, is the great Christie convention or absolute belief that you can just put on a false beard and you will be treated as somebody else. And
she never improved on that one.
She
always believed that. When you think of think of a killer disguised in a later book as a butler serving a group of people that they have been very close friends with for many years, and no one recognizes that person. The podcast All About Agatha, which is a wonderful American podcast about the books, they like to sound alarms whenever an actor is mentioned or whether the idea of costuming is mentioned, because Christie abuses that beautifully over and over again from start to finish. She never got better at that.
Yep.
The one that also gets me there is, well, because they're cousins, it would have been so easy for her to impersonate.
Yes.
What?
And also, she can do John's handwriting.
Yes,
and that's great.
No, better. She,
in the poison book, but also in the note, summons him to the fake thing, which we've heard nothing about up till that point.
Better than that, she can do John's handwriting. She can do Alfred doing John's handwriting. I mean, that's a level of mimesis that no one's probably ever considered before or since.
Yeah.
Just to wrap this up then, we covered a great many aspects of the plotting, of what we thought was successful, what we think is unsuccessful. As we said at the start, this is the book that is almost seen as the start of the Golden Age. What do we think Christie herself took forward from here to go on to become so incredibly successful in the genre? And indeed, what do we think Golden Age detection itself learned from this to go on to become this recognized era of detective plotting that so many of us have become so obsessed with? What lessons were learned by both the author and the genre as a whole through the publication of this book? And obviously, if you want to mention The Cask by Frew and Wills Cross, you will get 10 bonus points as well.
Well, then I would say that she showed that there is a viable and brilliant alternative to The Cask by Frew and Wills Cross.
Just 10 points, fine. I'm a man of my word.
I think that she created something that was, gosh, all the things she's accused of, I think she shows she wasn't. That was not formulaic, that was personable. She introduced us to a group of human beings who were involved in something, you know, mysterious and tragic. And I think in Poirot, she created one of the great characters of literature. And so that served her well. Even as she got tired of him, none of us did. And I think she provided a great foundation for herself going forward that way.
It does feel as if the detective stories prior to this were built around a kind of a gimmick. Your detective is blind, or your detective is this, well, your detective is Sherlock Holmes, or your detective is a facsimile of Sherlock Holmes. or your detective is John Thorndike, who is this medical genius who sees everything incredibly quickly or whatever. It does feel as if there was a real gimmick about something in these short form detective stories.
Well, there's a moment in the book that I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
Go for it. You go.
There's a moment in the book that I did not remember, and it is now one of my favorite moments. And that is when Poirot tells Hastings, he gets tears in his eyes and tells Hastings, this woman saved me. She saved my people, these Belgian refugees, the things she did for us. And I will not make any mistakes or let her killer go free. He personalizes it in a way I don't remember it, even in Orient Express, that I think a lot of people have imposed a personalization on it, adapters have, that isn't quite there. In this book, he's so human. And that was a very touching moment.
Yeah, and I would say she saw what you could do with a household. Hastings is a visitor, but it's the people who live in the house who are interesting. It's a household, and through the household, you can establish great characters, great motives, great relationships, great undetected relationships, and a wider community outside, a village and the farmer and shop and the chemist, the guy in the chemist shop.
The very domesticity of this book becomes important. Mm-hmm. I had forgotten also how much of its period it was in terms of World War I, the rationing, the details about the domesticity and the way the house functions become important to the mystery. She didn't always do that, but she did it really well here. And when she did choose to do that, she did it brilliantly.
Yeah, and my great contention is always that if you wanted a sociological history of England over a period from 1920 to 1975 or whatever, you couldn't do worse than read her. And obviously it is a certain sector of life, but she's right. I mean, she, because she's got to make the murder happen, and she's got to have details, and there've got to be clues. So if Agatha Christie tells me that a household of that size would have gone down from 5 gardeners to 3 gardeners, I think she's probably right. And the Daily Woman comes in later books 3 times a week, or whatever. She's going to get those details right. She knows them. And that's not what she was intending to do, but actually it will tell you. And for instance, the women, they're in this book, they're starting to get some freedoms because of the First World War. And you see the women in the books developing over the years and becoming career women or being able to achieve more.
It's the women in this book who work. The men don't work. The women work.
Mm.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, there's the two
Mary gardeners. Works the land, yeah.
Yeah, the two gardeners at the house. And I think they say we've had to cut down to however many gardeners, but one of them's a woman now in dungarees or something. And
yes.
Yeah, absolutely. A land girl.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's probably a good place to stop. Thank you, guys. This has been a lot of fun.
Okay, guys.
Thank you very much.
Lovely to see you.
Indeed.
Almost makes up. Almost makes up.
Almost, but
not quite.
Yeah, we'll do it again. I had a good time.
It was great. I really enjoyed that.
Good.
Thanks, Jim, for setting it up.
Yeah, good for you.
Thank you for being involved. Otherwise, it's just me talking to myself, which is nowhere near as entertaining.